Thank you so much for being here, folks. I think this is the time to let you know that I don't know. I really don't know. Hello and welcome to the African Tech Roundup, episode 137. This is where we round up the most important tech, digital, and innovation highlights from across the African continent. Shout out to the teams at Business Live and Multimedia Live for bringing our show to their audiences via businesslive.co.za and wherever Multimedia Live podcasts are streamed. My name is Andile Masugu. Thank you for tuning in. Now, here's to hoping you are healthy and safe. What as the world braves the COVID-19 crisis, a situation which will be the subject of this particular installment of the show. And so joining me today, I'm pleased to say, in the guest co-host seat is returning friend of the show, Eugenio Garladone. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing very well. I'm under lockdown, as everybody, I'm sure, listening to the podcast. And it's a total pleasure to be back in the new seat. It's quite comfortable.
You have a fresh new baby on lockdown that makes three. That must be crazy right now.
Yeah, we didn't plan it. Newborn and lockdown are not the perfect combination, but I can also see it as an extended paternity leave. So can't complain.
Alessandro.
Alessandro is the first name, and the second name is?
I believe it's Andile.
It is Andile.
I'll have you know I'm more partial to the second name.
I'm sure you are.
Well done. You really called your baby Andile.
I did. Actually, it took a long time. We didn't have a name when we left the hospital, and it took us a full 10 days to come up with the two names. But now we're really happy.
That's incredible. I happen to be the third born of three boys. Wow. So it's quite interesting that you have as your third born Andile, which is, yeah, quite a thing. That's really interesting. Listen, for those of you who don't know Eugenio, he's an associate professor in media studies at Wits University, and he's also an associate research fellow in new media and human rights in the program in comparative media law and policy at the University of Oxford. He's also the author of a book called China, Africa, and the Future of the Internet, which, of course, provided the springboard for our discussion the last time he was on the show. That was episode 132, would you believe? It was a fascinating episode entitled, Is the Africa-China or China-Africa Tech and Innovation Dynamic Win-Win? Well, it's now among the top five most listened episodes we've ever published. Congratulations, man. Thank you for bringing your swag to our pad.
Thank you. I had no idea that I made it so high up in the list, but it was, for me, I had a few podcasts in my career. It was definitely the most fun I had. So speaking with you and us, Ruman, was a total pleasure. So thank you for re-inviting me.
The pleasure was certainly ours. A lot of what we talked about in that episode, obviously resonating with what was, you know, topical at the time, but certainly more so what is now evolving as a much greater narrative about the role of China in Africa and the role of tech in that narrative. And of course, everything you've researched and brought to bear in that discussion, truly, truly, truly gold. If you haven't listened to that show, again, it's episode 132. It's entitled, Is the Africa-China, China-Africa Tech and Innovation Dynamic Win-Win, featuring Eugenio Garladone. You can find it on our website at africantechroundup.com right now. But before we push on, we have a special guest joining us today. Hello and welcome to the African Tech Roundup, Professor Londré Seigneur.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Thank you for making the time. I'm actually going to take a deep breath before I introduce you to the village, Londré, because your bio is quite a read. But I think it's quite important that people have a better sense of why you're here today and why, you know, we're really privileged to have you factor in on our discussion. So Londré is a senior fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program at the Brookings Institution. He is a fellow at Stanford University's Center for African Studies. He is the chairman of the Global Network for Africa's Prosperity, an Andrew Carnegie Fellow, a 2016 Woodrow Wilson Public Policy Fellow, and he is also now a full professor and founding co-director of the Fourth Industrial Revolution and Globalization 4.0 at Thunderbird School of Global Management. Yo, before I carry on, Londré, where were you born?
Thank you very much for the too kind introduction. I was born in Cameroon, and I grew up in Cameroon. I spent time between Cameroon, France, Canada, and the US.
But then before your current sort of full professorship, you were a professor in Alaska? What are the coldest places on earth? You're from Cameroon. I'm struggling.
let me tell you that probably Montreal, where I spent many years, was colder than Anchorage. At least when I spent a few days there, because people told me, well, it is much warmer now. However, my coldest year that I spent since I was born were the year I spent in Montreal.
Wow, that has to be global warming, because to my mind, Anchorage should be easily colder than Montreal, in my mind anyway. Listen, I'm not even done with your bio, as you know, Landry. So let me just carry on and, you know, I'll check in with you. Landry is also a Desmond Tutu Fellow. He is a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader. And then prior to all this, Landry was a managing consultant of a strategy firm, as well as a visiting scholar at the University of Oxford. He's also served on a bunch of boards, including that of Ampion Catalyst for Entrepreneurship and Innovation in Africa and the United Nations Association of Canada, Montreal. And he was appointed by a United Nations Undersecretary General to serve on the Global Network on Digital Technologies for Sustainable Urbanization. Now, Professor Signe has also authored many academic and policy publications focused on the African continent, the global political economy, politics of economic reform and foreign aid, emerging and frontier markets, institutional change, political regimes. Listen, the list goes on. But perhaps most importantly for our discussion today, Landry's poised to have a new book published called Unlocking Africa's Business Potential. Now, the idea is not to position him or ourselves as the preeminent authorities in any of these subjects, but it's certainly our intent to make the most of this amazing brain. Thank you so much again for joining us, Landry.
Thank you very much for having me, and congratulations on your great show. Everyone says, singing your praise.
I humbly receive the affirmation, and again, I am nothing without amazing company. So, Eugenio, thanks so much for fielding the offer to co-pilot this episode with me. Between the two of us, I think certainly more ideas than we do have space on this particular episode, but we're going to give this a roaring try. We want to unpack over the next short while our feelings about COVID-19, you know, as interested and affected parties, you know, thoughtfully sorting through some of the ideas that are bubbling to the surface around the economic impact and recovery theories that are making the rounds on the internet and in academic circles, but also in media circles. Now, I'm not going for a myth-busting public service announcement vibe with this show. My intent in inviting you both here is to curate a conversation that is less a deep dive into, say, the medical science side of things, but more maybe about an analyzing Africa's socioeconomic prospects from a resilience standpoint. So I'm hoping that we can make sense of the ongoing fallout, you know, as governments, everyday citizens, institutions, basically all of us decide how best to respond to this crisis. I want us to consider the practical trade-offs, the adaptations, the sacrifices that Africans and perhaps citizens of the planet might need to prepare to make in order to survive and then thrive when this is all behind us. So the thing we'll do, Landry, is use some of the themes from your new book as a springboard for the discussion. And then we'll try and work out to what extent the COVID-19 situation either challenges or validates some of the deductions you've made in that book. Does that sound good, guys?
Sounds great.
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's start this way. Perhaps by you guys telling me what immediately pops into your heads when you think COVID-19 and Africa right now. What comes to mind for you, Eugenio?
Well, I think the thing that comes to mind are many, but I think it's experiment. And here in South Africa, unfortunately, I have not a continental perspective on this one because I'm locked down. And with 3 kids, you can't just explore too much what's happening around the world. But we are on day 21 of our lockdown. And as part of it, there has been a ban on alcohol, a ban on cigarettes, a ban on traffic, basically. And of course, the obsession is very much on the disease and how to prevent people from dying. But I would love that some of my colleagues at WITS or in other universities in South Africa and across the world would also look into like the outcomes of these massive social experiment. You know, as you know, alcohol is a big issue here in South Africa. And people have to go dry all of a sudden, definitely with the extension. And what is these going to provoke into family lives and cigarettes and less pollution and so forth. And this is just some examples. So I think we should be able to read. Of course, there is a lot of anxiety going around, but as social scientists, we should be able to springboard new pieces of research to understand also what is happening because of these byproducts of the spread of the virus. I think it's there is a great challenge, but there are so many opportunities in this moment. So I think this experiment is unique, and we should be able to have the data, not just on like how many people are infected and so forth, but learning from it. Can we change our way to deal with social lives in ways that were impossible to think even like a few weeks ago?
A lot of our listeners won't be familiar with what you've referenced as the problem South Africa has with alcohol specifically. What are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about domestic violence. I'm talking about baby being born with issues related to abuse of alcohol by mothers and so forth. So this is in the news on a regular basis. If you are a listener of the most common radios, this is a problem that is talked about. It's not under the carpet. But now we are in a completely different scenarios. And I think we should learn from it.
So South Africa has one of the highest rates of crime related to alcohol abuse anywhere in the world. And as you say, that dysfunction often starts domestically in homes, but often ends up in our streets. Also, a fairly ridiculously, unacceptably high rate of alcohol-related accidents on roads and the impact it has on public medical health care and the toll it takes, again, indirectly on young people and social well-being and mental health, etc. Really interesting what you're pointing to here, this need for us to identify how these experiments are going to pan out for us. I wonder what comes to mind for you, Landry.
Many questions come to my mind when I heard about the word COVID-19 in Africa. So what are the key vulnerabilities in Africa when it comes to COVID spread? So as we know, African countries are facing numerous challenges and policy constraints, which increase vulnerabilities. Let's talk about the limited preparedness for epidemics. Until mid-February, almost no African country had the ability to really detect the virus. Fortunately, the African Center for Disease Control quickly empowered many of the countries in the continent. So we have the high incidence and mortality rates and prevalence of other infectious diseases, so which will also worsen in case of a higher spread on the continent. We have the high social cohesion and gathering, although now they have been forbidden, but we know that many are not respected. For example, some countries, like in Uganda, we can have an attendance of about 82% of citizens to traditional and religious activities. So those are factors which increase vulnerability. I can also speak about the weak healthcare system in general. Most of the African countries are lagging compared to the rest of the world in terms of healthcare system. We have the limited capacity to provide critical care due to weak infrastructure. Some countries have less than 3 ventilators in case of a worsening situation for citizens who may be sick. We have the limited social protection and systems. For example, on one hand, you have lockdowns, but on the other hand, many citizens cannot have access to food, to clean water.
I'm going to jump in there because it's a lot of the stuff I'd like us to get into in more detail. And one of the things that leapt out to me, I actually just put it down as you said it, this concern with Africa's profile as far as pre-existing conditions within the population. I'm from Zimbabwe and live in South Africa. As you'll know, in those countries, we're dealing with a fairly high prevalence of TB cases as well as people living with HIV. And the thing that comes to mind for me with parents living in Zimbabwe and my two brothers, my brother and his wife and their children living there, and knowing just how limited their options are, God forbid, should anything happen to them as far as potential exposure to this crisis. I think for me, that's been the most sobering aspect. You know, the idea that you've just given us a laundry list of vulnerabilities, but for me, the first thing that comes to mind when I hear sort of COVID-19 in Africa, literally, I see my family in my mind's eye. I see my parents. I see two amazing academics who've done a lot for their society and their country and are now unable to access the healthcare they regularly get in South Africa on an annual basis, and are pretty much sitting ducks, except for what I believe to be the grace of God. So yeah, I don't mean to bring the mood down, but I think it's important that we almost anchor these ideas in the stakes for the everyday African.
You are absolutely right. Yesterday night, an African-American friend of mine sent me a CNN video showing people in Kiberia, in the slum in Kenya, and who were competing to receive food because now they are not technically allowed to sell. They were informal small trader, so they don't have necessary revenue and they don't have access to in quantity and quality to food and to clean water. I've seen no social distance amongst them, many people fighting to get some food. So those vulnerabilities are not just words, they're not just technical aspects. And I think, as you pointed out, one of my first reaction when the COVID outbreak started to reach the African continent was to send enough resources, for example, to my family, my dad who still live in Cameroon, so that they can acquire enough supplies in order to be able to spend 2 or 3 months without almost going out. And not everyone on the continent necessarily has the ability to purchase things for many months in advance. I have discussed also with some of my friends. Of course, I kept in touch with some of my friends who have not been successful necessarily at the university level or at school. And then there are small traders and small restaurant owners, some of them. And I can tell you, it is shocking. They cannot easily feed their family. So the reason why it's important to connect both those personal history, I think, with the broader systemic consideration, which make us better understand the leverages also that we can use to fix or to help provide the most effective response first to the health crisis, but also to the broader economic crisis, which is also looming.
On the upside of this, I was truly impressed, to be honest, by some of the responses to the crisis in places like South Africa, but also Ethiopia. And I'm not a fan of the idea of international development. It comes with a lot of baggage. It comes with the prehistory of colonialism with it. But I think also the exposure to certain ideas, Landry, I think we also share these, the experience in the world of international development and policymaking. And I think exposure to scientific evidence that sometimes went wrong, let's be clear, has also enabled some leaders in Africa, as compared to Europe, to be able to listen to the evidence and the science. And we see what demagogues in Western countries are doing. We had the example of Donald Trump in recent days, or Boris Johnson in the UK. And then we would have expected these countries to be leading definitely in scientifically grounded responses to it. But these are actually coming from Africa. And this is unique. And I think we should recognize that more. Obviously, it's a high level, it's a structural level. It's a very far away from individual experiences. But this is a response that has impressed many. And I think we should also break the narrative of just the fragilities of Africa. Definitely those are there. But some of the experiences that have matured in the continent are proving quite effective right now.
Coming from you, that's a lot, Eugenio, especially considering you're Italian, you still have family in Italy. No secret, it's one of the hardest hit countries by this crisis to date. What has your sense been fielding live experiences of what's going down in a place like Italy and then living through the response to this crisis in South Africa?
Well, I share very much your feelings because my mind goes to my parents. They live in a small village in northern Italy. And they are in their 70s, so I'm afraid for their health. And they are being good citizens, so staying at home. But at the same time, Italy has been very much on the front line. You know, after the responses from China, it was probably the first democracy that had to deal with huge numbers of individual affected. And so they had to just learn a lot from trial and error. What I'm more surprised by are countries like Spain or the UK or the US, who had time to learn from the mistake that Italy made. And the mistakes, I'm not like pinning politicians for these mistakes. We're inevitable. We are all human beings. But there could have been much more learning from Italy in countries that are nearby. And I see much more ability to listen and to learn in a country like South Africa than I see in the UK. So that's what I mean.
And so what would you point to as a learning point from the Italian situation?
Definitely. I think Italy had to face the crisis as it were happening, and other countries had learned from Italy. And
but no, what I mean is, what do you see as South Africa having learned from that, that perhaps other countries?
Oh, I think South Africa decided to go for a national lockdown immediately. Italy had to first create these kind of red zones around the most infected areas. And some places, the United States have done something similar for New York and for California. And they've learned that these kind of more limited, geographically limited ways of locking down were not effective. And so they decided to go straight. And this is also the case of Ethiopia, many other countries, Kenya, other countries on the continent. And the panic, I think this is the tragic lives of doctors on the front line who had to decide to triage which individuals affected by the disease were going to receive care and ventilators and which didn't, had also inspired some of the responses, saying here in South Africa, we are probably not going to fight a disease and win over their disease. But we don't want to be in this tragic situation where we have like crowds of people around hospitals that can't provide help to them. This is what Italy and now New York, unfortunately, had to face. This is the most tragic ethical decision that someone can make. And I think these are being prevented right now. And this is really commendable.
Londres, you know, I've been digesting insights that my wife Stabiso has gleaned. Stabiso is a health economist, and she recently attended a webinar hosted by the International Health Economics Association. And it featured preliminary modeling that conservatively projected that the COVID-19 pandemic would result in a recessionary impact on the UK economy roughly five times worse than the worst one experienced in our lifetimes. Now, I've also been reading stuff being put out by consultants like McKinsey, you know, folks theorizing about how institutions and corporations might need to work through this crisis and listening in on conversations people are having via, you know, video conference. These are Africa-focused founders, investors, C-suite executives, academics, everyday people are having conversations about what the impact might be. And, you know, just listening to Eugenio there, realizing that, you know, there's learning that we're going to need to do in retrospect, obviously, all of us who survived this, but there's learning that needs to be done on the go. And what is your sense of the role of projections of this nature in influencing what we should be doing right now, especially in the light of considerations like, you know, life above all else, which has become the prevailing wisdom by a lot of countries around the world? I would hazard that by certain estimates, at least economically, you know, just allowing this disease to mow through the world without trying to stop it would probably be the most economically efficient way to deal with it, except it probably be politically incorrect and probably for the most part not ethical from a public health perspective. So what's the role of all this thinking, and where do you think it should fit in the minds of those of us who are actively trying to figure out what to do next?
I think as Isinio pointed out, we are bridging the world of science and policy, of ideas and action. So at least that is one of the, I will not say merit, but leaders have demonstrated a higher likelihood of bridging the world of science and policy as they are facing COVID-19. So those projections show that it is extremely important to take action and to be bold. You may recall that at the beginning of the health crisis, many observers were thinking that Africa will not be drastically affected. And I was very worried about that because preparedness should take into consideration a possible worst scenario. For now, let's say that many of the countries which are the best prepared to face epidemics or pandemics on the continent are also some of the most affected. Let me speak about South Africa, Algeria, Egypt, Morocco, Tunisia. On the other hand, some of the countries with the weakest, let's say, state capacity or health system are also less affected. So the dramatic change may occur when you will see the weakest countries or the less prepared country if they become also the most affected one. So the different projections were taken very seriously. I think at the Brookings Institution, my colleague have made projections. UNICA, McKinsey, as you spoke also, and the World Bank recently, which highlighted the fact that Africa will face the first recession in 25 years. So those alarming projections have contributed at least to a beginning of bolder leadership in the international community, but also in the African side. For example, the IMF has announced measures to reduce debt on the African continent. It was the same for France and the Paris Club. You have many ongoing conversations about debt relief, but on one hand. But on the other hand, African countries are also taking serious action to, on one hand, curb or stop end the health crisis, but on the other hand, explore ways to sustain economic activities. So, yeah, I think it's extremely important to have those type of scientific evidence, because leaders have demonstrated, at least now, that they are taking it seriously. When they challenge it, they have seen the consequence of challenging it, so they are opening their ear. And even, not to name them, some of the presidents who have the reputation of not taking the scientific evidence for granted have acknowledged following the recommendations of scientifics, even when they disagree. And so I'm speaking about President Trump, for example. In one of his press conferences, he clearly said that he doesn't necessarily share the viewpoint of some of his doctors or experts. However, he has still taken action to follow on their recommendations.
So some of these bold moves Landry's alluding to include, you know, the experiments you were alluding to, Eugenio. I mean, let's take something as, on the surface, perhaps noble and unassuming and unproblematic as banning the sale and public consumption of alcohol, cigarettes. That is an unprecedented, depending how you look at it, an unprecedented overreaching of moral regulation, which has, you know, folks like me a little concerned that we might look back on these times, and granted, we'll be grateful that the projections and the science emboldened our leaders to make these bold boss moves on one hand, but on the other, we might look back with regret at how much of our freedoms and our personal rights to self-determination we gave away in the name of sort of protecting ourselves from a virus.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I want to make sure that I'm not a prohibitionist. You know, I enjoy my glass of wine here and there and my beer with friends. So I'm not.
And balance that, by the way, I do not drink alcohol. If anything, I'm making this observation, observing how many fellow teetotalers have been very vocal on social media on some, hey, I hope it never comes back, you know, and I'm like, wait a minute.
No, but my point is exactly, that's what I make. Of course, the medical scientists are at the forefront, and it's so important. But I think this could be the value of research in protecting freedom of expression. So there should be, I'm not in favor of expanding the ban for the next years or future to come. But if we had the information, if we had the data that's showing to people who overindulge in alcohol of what has happened into these like 3 weeks or month and a half, and how many lives were saved, how many incidents of the cases of domestic violence were avoided, how people find their way into an alcohol-free routines and so forth. If we had the data that could tell us what we gain and what we learned, that would be incredibly valuable information for public campaigns. Say, you know what, when we turn it down, that's what happened. And why don't you, as an individual with free choice and freedom of expression and freedom to decide what is your path towards happiness, take that into account. That opportunity is not going to come again.
Yeah.
And that's where I say that the focus has to be in protecting ourselves and protecting our communities. But if people don't have three kids as I do and can use their brain power to solve some of these questions, I think it would be so valuable in the years to come.
Should research point to the fact that Italy, for example, typically has a much higher consumption rate of tobacco than other parts of Europe, and maybe that played a factor along with a generally older population, among other factors? It might prove to be a very strong case for shaping policy around tobacco, for instance. But I suppose what I'm talking about is, for the most part, almost unchecked wholesale transfer of regulating human moral activity that we're sort of giving over to our governments and perhaps large tech firms, which we'll talk about later, and really not thinking about where that could lead us if we're not careful.
Let me say that exceptional circumstances, those are part of the social contract. If you think about the notion of modern state has emerged, citizens were giving up some of their fundamental rights and freedom in order to receive protection from the state in a specific territory. So we have to make a distinction between perhaps democracies and non-democratic countries. So those exceptional circumstances which empower some of the leaders to restrict some of the freedom of movement, among others, technically in democracy, things should come back to normal. And if not, you also have the check and balance system where they are within the executive, the judiciary, and the legislature to ensure that, or to reduce, at least counter the power of the executive. Where I may be a little bit more concerned is mostly in non-democratic countries, or in, let's say, democracies of weak quality, where you have hyper-presidentialism and where the level of checks and balance, what we call horizontal accountability, may be lower. However, I think that under exceptional circumstances, will not be responsible for a leader not to take the proper course of action as long as they respect the constitution and as long as the other institution which are playing an oversight role could step in when the situation come back to normal. So it is mostly non-democratic countries where coming back to normal may be more complex, because those will also require a mobilization of the civil society, or will depend on the goodwill of the leader.
I'd like to push back on that a little bit, because it is my experience as someone who didn't choose to be born in Zimbabwe black in 1984 to a recently independent Zimbabwe, that social contract was not one I entered into willingly. And of course, I don't want to conflate my concern with our thinking around these issues with the idea that nothing should be done and that sovereign governments shouldn't have the right to sort of act in the best interests of their countries if it means sort of impeding on certain rights and privileges from time to time. I do just wonder if we are applying ourselves sufficiently, especially in the context of democracy, to how and when that ought to happen, if those conversations are adequately taking into account the lottery that determines where you're born and the varying levels of access to privilege that affords you. Some have argued that perhaps this is not the time to have that argument, given how, you know, as we discussed earlier, we still have families confined within the borders of countries that are experiencing crazy vulnerabilities. But the fact is, I think COVID-19 is giving us an opportunity here that we should grasp, which is to face up to the realities of what the system is set up to do and do well, for whom and when, and what the limitations of those situations are. If you understand what I'm meaning, guys, I don't know if you guys feel me on that.
Yes, I think no system is perfect. Even when you speak about democracies, we have different qualities of democracies, from perhaps the electoral one, which have a lower level, for example, of political rights and civil liberties, and perhaps weaker checks and balances, to more liberal type of democracies and substantial type of democracies, which probably provide a larger space for participation, for competition, and human rights, economic rights, among other factors. So I think this is an important time to have all those conversations. I don't think that is a conversation for later. But we need to also make a distinction. And I want to be certain that I understand your question. Are you suggesting that, for example, as lockdown and quarantine, freedom of movement, for example, leader may not do so? But we have to make a clear distinction. And the clear distinction here is between what is absolutely necessary to end the health crisis and additional measures or abuses resulting from those actions.
Okay.
So abuses should not be tolerated. For example, seeing the security forces beating up citizens, etc., this should not be tolerated.
That's a really good question for you to ask. I think Eugenio will know this because he's living in South Africa. The chief of police in country at the moment has built somewhat of a reputation of being anti-alcohol. You know, his press statements are very entertaining, often for the wrong reasons, because he often alludes to how if he had his way, no one would ever have a drink ever again. All the bars would be shut. And so there's a version of that that's being normalized. I'm using alcohol intentionally because it, on the surface of it, feels ridiculous. Come on. I mean, come now. Yes, it's just a glass of wine. Let people be. And I think you're right. I happen to have a strong view that alcohol isn't good for you, but I have a sense that, you know, everyone should have the option to have as much or as little of it to their own potential detriment. But that decision has implications on me, potentially in the negative, in that I've had to watch people I love be unable to handle their alcohol and die from it. I've known people who've died in accidents that were caused by drunk drivers. And I know what the toll of freedom in that particular space is, but I am wholly unwilling to completely give up on allowing people that freedom in the name of sort of protecting, you know, our greater good as society,
and
even in an area as small as alcohol.
On maybe taking it away from alcohol and going back to democracy, I think we also shouldn't get too fixated with the higher level of democratic institutions. So a country is democratic or not. And democracy is so many different levels. So a very democratic kind of conversation that I experienced recently was the one in my own university, where at the beginning, the sense was, oh, let's just do business as usual. Let's go online. Let's go and then slowly, and the voices started to emerge both from staff and from students saying, you know what? South Africa has a very high level of mobile penetration, but still 15% or 20% of our students don't have access to mobile devices that would enable them to do the fancy, like, Ivy League kind of online thing. And there was a very open, very democratic, and very impassioned conversation that we had that transformed the view on what we should do with our own students, sort of like deciding to be more empathetic, to sort of just put ourselves into the shoes of the most vulnerable. And it was a pleasure to be part of that kind of conversation and seeing the very strong shift from a harder, we are a top institution, let's finish the academic here and we will all go online, with a deeper understanding of, you know, a lot of staff don't have the opportunity to work as they would work with school open, and a lot of students are vulnerable. And I think there are so many different layers of democracy. One is at the very top, but we should also consider democracy as it exercises in different type of communities and keep an eye on that. And I think a country would function, and this will be also another interesting question, whether or not different types of democracy at different levels, at different scales, are in tune with one another. So is the top leadership enforcing something that communities are fighting against because they see as overbearing and unsustainable? Or the local communities, the household and the institution and the firm are sort of in line and they are in this together. And in some countries, I see this feeling of, well, you know what? For now, we are in this together. And it is something that it's kind of beautiful to watch. And I don't know if this can endure in the long term, but again, it's an interesting experience and it's an opportunity we should seize. And I have never seen South Africa as united as it is right now.
I really like where you've taken that thought, because, you know, there's a lot of reading I've been doing lately on people that are pointing to data points that suggest that complete shutdowns for most African nations are probably not the way to go, taking into account very unique sort of cultural, social, economic realities in different African countries. Now, back to the question Landry asked me earlier on, am I suggesting that we should have this super loose, super free situation where everybody decides what they do and not allow or welcome the government's enforcing of certain interim measures in order to ensure that people comply. No, I wouldn't go as far as that, but I would encourage like a thoughtfulness that I think is embodied in the anecdote you just shared there, Eugenio, which is generally as human beings, especially when we're thinking about sort of macroeconomics or trying to sort of create files and folders for everything, we're given to oversimplifications about what works. It's been quite amusing for me to read through what a lot of the consulting firms are suggesting institutions and corporations and governments do in response to this. So that's kind of where I'm coming from with this laundry. I'm not an anarchist that just wants to see the total decentralization of rule, at least not as far as governance at most sort of sovereign level. But I do wonder if we are sort of mindlessly applauding some of our lawmakers and governors overreaching at a time when all of us are worried about just getting out of this alive.
Let me also just be clear here. Prohibiting alcohol is not necessarily something that I would have encouraged. The conversation is about the broader reasonable health measures where there is a convergence with scientific evidence decided, and not just locally, but also in partnership with other regional or international partners. But as you pointed out, many countries are seizing this opportunity to overreach or to over-restrict, and those should be watched very closely because the connection, although some will highlight perhaps domestic violence, but prohibiting alcohol to all because some may abuse it, I think the one abusing should be the one targeted versus a broader systematic prohibition. But again, those questions are critical and need to be discussed, because in most democracies, the total prohibition of alcohol will be difficult to pass, because those same lawmakers are also some of the ones consuming those, among others.
I'm so glad we've taken this little detour, because, you know, it was important for me to sort of demonstrate to everybody listening and to you guys as my conversants that I am invested in us successfully navigating the situation. I have very close relatives, even here in the UK, who are in the medical profession, who have recently been diagnosed with COVID-19. And I am fully invested in us getting through this and getting through this better and stronger and with as many of us alive and healthy. But I'm also very, very, very concerned that we don't do so at the expense of future that we haven't properly thought out. And so with that behind us, let's jump into this book, Unlocking Africa's Business Potential, Trends, Opportunities, Risks, and Strategies. Landry, I've had a squiz at this book. I'm a good way in. And you didn't see this this crisis coming, did you?
So, of course, I anticipated that we'll have a crisis, perhaps not necessarily to the extent of COVID, because the broader economies, the global economies, have been growing for a too long time. Relatively sustainably. So I think that African economies have never been as resilient as they are now. So they may not be the most resilient economies globally, but they have almost never been as resilient as they are now. And these are for many reasons. Of course, the level of competitiveness has substantially increased over the past couple of decades, with many African countries represented in the top 100 most competitive countries globally. Not enough to my taste, but an increased number and many, so it's a good news. You also have, of course, some people may consider it as a negative point, but I think the African population is also an important strength. If well managed, we have the increase in terms of accountabilities. If you look in the late 80s, most African countries were authoritarian, if not all. Now we have an increased number of more African countries living under a democratic regime than the contrary. And
sorry, can I pause there? Like, why would people look at population growth as anything but a good thing?
Because you have the demographic transition. And for as of now, the continent needs something around 20 million jobs per year. So, of course, number will fluctuate, with some estimate about 11, 12 million to 20 million jobs per year. So there's a shortcoming in terms of unemployment is one of the major concern. So, and the high level of poverty, as you know, countries such as Nigeria and Democratic Republic of Congo have some of the highest proportion of poverty globally. So that's why some consider the African demography as a potential curse. I think instead that he could offer a tremendous opportunity, but of course, leaders also have to better manage the demographic transition. They have to empower the youth, increase the level of education achievements, and also provide, adjust, train the young people or to the work of the future. So I think if well managed, the African population is definitely a blessing. But if well managed.
What in the writing of this book do you point to as Africa's role as far as an opportunity to position cleverly and emphatically? So we'll talk about how you thought of this in the writing of this book, which was, I imagine, done mostly long before this COVID-19 thing even became a thing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But yeah, so what was your sense of what was, I don't want to call it broken because I don't think you used those words, but you definitely point to attention and the sort of opportunity that you, I think, describe Africa as being in a position to contribute to solving for or positioning around.
So I see, let's say, about 10 to 11 trends, broader trends. So before highlighting some of those trends clearly, so I wanted to mention, of course, the broader competitiveness of the African economies that I highlighted there. Another important trend is also the increased foreign direct investment and the diversification of African partners, name China, the Saudi Arabian, the North Korean, the Indian, the Turkish, and among others. So those are the diversification of partners have provided also the continent with some leverage and the possibility, which is not always used, but that's why I'm saying possibility, the possibility to better negotiate deals. So we have two also other factors. One is the African continental free trade area, which will face a challenge because the countries were supposed to be trading under the CFTA as of July of this year. However, let me point out that the African continental free trade area was, as you know, and most of the listeners know, was adopted in 2018. And then a sufficient number of countries have ratified for it to come into force in 2019. But the actual trading under the African continental free trade area is planned to be starting as of July 2020. But this is still subject of additional negotiation as when it was planned, COVID was not there. Finally, we also have the fourth industrial revolution. Many countries, including in the fight against COVID, which is increasingly empowering people both in the formal and the informal sector, businesses, corporation, government. Everyone speaks, for example, about zipline in Rwanda, Ghana, and other countries delivering blood. So you have artificial intelligence helping to predict or to find some of the solution to many of the challenges which are faced by many African countries. So those are some of the broader trend related to the transformation of African economies, for which even if COVID-19 impact on the short run, over the long run, the continent will still perform well. As a matter of fact, I think the estimate from the International Monetary Fund have shown that it is mostly in 2020 that the continent will be affected, and mostly because some of the largest economies, such as South Africa and Nigeria on the continent, will be among the most affected economies. However, as of 2021, growth in Africa will come back to a reasonably high level. So I want to point out that, yes, on one hand, we have to be concerned about the direct and short-term impact of COVID-19, the health impact, but also the economic one. But on the other hand, if you think about the post-COVID strategy, many of the discussions or conclusion or trends observed in the book will be quite similar.
Your book is presenting a very bullish notion around Africa and its potential.
Absolutely.
So are you absolutely as bullish as you were before?
I would say that I'm probably even more, except perhaps for some sectors like the one of infrastructure, which require massive investment and for which many of the key investors may not be available, or investment may be less available potentially, or in the mining on oil and gold and gas sector perhaps.
So Landry, I'm going to come back to this because I do want you to give me a sense of why you feel that way. And I'll give you a moment to think about your top three areas in which you feel Africa has its strongest proposition post a situation of this nature. But I want to pose a question to Eugenio. You know, a lot of people are even more bullish than they were prior to this whole crisis about the future of Africa. For a lot of people, it's forget the leapfrog. It is the fast forward that is the new black. People are seeing this situation as a backhanded blessing. And I say this very carefully. I don't mean to trivialize the pain that the world is going through right now. But a lot of people, and I'm attending quite a few, you know, of these webinars, I'm speaking to founders and listening to investors, and a lot of them are seeing this as a backhanded blessing. And so my question to you is, can we really innovate our way out of this to a new normal that's actually better for everyday Africans than everything that came before? You'd spend 10 years writing a book about what arguably is the most pragmatic relationship Africa has with a foreign trade partner, which is China. When I say pragmatic, I say relative to what is often rhetoric first or values first or rhetoric forward engagements that typically characterize relationships with the US and parts of Europe and the UK and so on. You might have some pragmatic insights about how cautiously optimistic to be.
I'm very optimistic. I share Landry's view. And I want to use
an image. Oh, this is hopeless. I have two hopeless optimists on this call. I can't believe it.
I want to use an image that you just created. You know, you gave a minute to Landry to think. I think these can be seen as an opportunity for some countries, clearly not all countries in Africa or not all countries anywhere in the world are ready for seizing these in equal ways, but to pose and think about vulnerabilities and strength. And if this is done properly, it's not just like, let's rush back to business as usual and forget about this very difficult moment. There is clearly a lot of anxiety in our hearts. And it can make some of the processes that are already activated. I very much share the view of Landry that, many African countries have never been as resilient as now, but also seizing it even more because we know better. And I use you, you refer my work in China and Africa. And one thing that I try to stress in my book is a lot of the big narratives, unfortunately, are those of like, what is China doing to Africa? What is the West doing to Africa? And what I try to do in the book, and I'm not alone, many scholars are doing something similar, is like recognizing the agency and the ability of combining different experiences, forms of innovation from the East and from the West and creating their own. Let's not forget that there's a lot of ingenuity and sort of creating, as South Africa is doing right now with COVID-19, you know, they keep saying, the WHO is saying, oh, South Africa has a very unique pattern. If you look at the curve of the COVID-19, it's different from South Korea, it's different from China, it's different from Italy, it's different from the United Kingdom and so forth. It's unique. So if we are able to pause and think about certain forms of uniqueness, the next step could be even not stronger, but could build on more solid grounds. And I think we should embark in this kind of process. And if I can add just another thing, you use the word leapfrogging. And this is used a lot, has been used a lot in, and even in the Landry's book, the information and communication technology sector, Africa doesn't have to use all the fixed line because we have the mobile phone. Absolutely true. It's kind of like obvious. But I think that we can move beyond that narrative, because what we have tended to think about leapfrogging is, let's forget an intermediate technology and lend it to the same technology that has been produced in the United States or in Finland, for that matter.
Or let's forget about the role of infrastructure altogether.
Well, at some levels we can. But the thing is that because of some of the very reasons that Landry indicates in the book and also in our conversation, our population growth. So Africa is the latest frontier when it comes to access to digital devices. I think Africa can sort of set its own terms, because a lot of, we see it in Ethiopia with the liberalization of the telecommunication, there's a lot of very hungry partners that want to do work on the continent. And maybe Africa can say, you know what? We want a different type of information society, not that looks like China with all this kind of like surveillance and social control, but not either the United States. We want to create our own more like ambitious and utopian view of what we can do with technology. And COVID-19 and coming together has showed us the way to do that. So I think there's a lot of strength. I'm sorry to be an optimist, but I have to be. I can't be otherwise.
I mean, look, it's not like I hate your optimism, and it's not that I'm not a hopeful African. It's just that I'm just cautious that we don't gloss over some of the more obvious realities that are being brought to light by this situation. For instance, you know, while we're having this conversation, what appears to be a reinvention of the world order is on the go to essentially, for the most part, from what I can tell, promote what came before or consolidate what came before. We might be sitting here going, you know, let's leapfrog our way out of this. And it's like, well, maybe it's deeper than that. Maybe Africa is not going to mirror what brought the Alibaba boom in Asia around the SARS epidemic. Maybe it won't be like that. Maybe we need to be more pragmatic about the nature of things and why we're in this position to begin with, and how it won't just be a matter of how smart we are, how determined we are, how together we are, that's going to get us out of this. I know it's a very, I'm bringing down the mood, gentlemen.
No, not at all. First, I want to point out some extremely important keywords brought by Isinio. The first one, agency. We cannot speak as if African leaders, either individually or collectively, do not have agency. Whether for the great things which are being accomplished on the continent or for the bad one, there is a level of agency, and one who speaks about agency also speaks about accountability for what is done, and also the definition of its own terms, how the continent could define its own term, which is one of the goals also of the CFT, although of course you are still a lot to be done for it to be successfully implemented. Cannot speak about African leaders or about African businesses or African in general as if they do not have agency, as if they cannot frame, shape, strategize and build the world the way. And when I speak about building the world, I'm speaking whether at the local level, at the sub-regional level, at the national level, or at the continental level, and of course, why not having a global contribution. Let me tell you that for the very first time, I participated in a lot of African negotiation about a couple of years ago, if I'm not wrong. I have seen the African negotiating with your counterpart in the AGOAC border conversation, and I have never seen African leaders speaking with one voice as I have seen then, and promoting the African continental free trade area. Even at the beginning of the conversation, the official position of the US was, we will not discuss or engage with the African continental free trade area because we don't think that it will work anyway, and because we prefer bilateral engagement or agreements. And recently, not just the United States trade representative or part of your team have issued a joint statement with the African Union, and in particular Ambassador Muchanga, demonstrating that they will engage with Africa also through the African Continental Free Trade Area. And I've attended many other conversations where US officials, including the interim coordinator of the Prosper Africa, which is the US program aiming at increasing two-way trade and investment between the US and African countries. So I've seen official communication and official support, including the commitment to provide some resources. So this shows that when African countries join forces and speak with one voice, we can see clear outcome, and including when engaging with the biggest powers.
I'm really encouraged to hear that. I've never heard, and certainly it's never been on mic on our show, that level of affirmation of just how much progress is being made as far as Africa being able to stand up for herself and represent our own interests.
I was the very first surprise, believe me, because I have been working also with many African countries, the representative ambassadors here, and I give some briefing before the negotiation. They usually have a meeting with experts to provide briefings, insights, and provide some strategies. But I must tell you that I was the very first surprised to see the unity in the African position and in the representative.
So I interrupted you. You have a thought, and I want you to get to that thought on your way to the final thought, which will be, give us your sense of the top three things that you think coming out of this crisis, Africa would do well to position around in order to assert itself in what's coming next. But don't lose your thoughts on your way there.
Absolutely. Thank you. So in my book, Unlocking Africa's Business Potential, I identify about, let's say, three categories of countries which I can connect now with COVID-19. And I think the classification of African economies, especially their past performance, can tell us a lot about the resilience or the different types of growth narratives that we'll see on the continent. So the first group of countries include countries which have had steady economic performance over the past 2 decades. So those countries will include, on one hand, the fast growers, like countries such as Rwanda, for example, or Ethiopia, and the slower growers with countries such as Morocco. So given the strong fundamentals of those economies, including the implementation of pro-growth policies, the improving ease of doing business and governance effectiveness, as well as their particular relation with international donors and investors, I think that post-COVID-19 phase, those countries will present a tremendous economic potential. This is the first category of countries. And of course, the growth rate will be different. So for example, countries such as Rwanda and Ethiopia will grow much faster than a country like Morocco. So the second group of countries include countries such as Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana. They have had a GDP growth rate which has improved significantly over the past decade. So if you see the first group, 2 decades of strong economic performance and with a strong basis for continued growth and to manage effectively shocks. So the second group is about a decade of relatively improved economic performance. So although those countries, this will be the second most resilient group of countries, and definitely they have fundamentals. You have the improved state capacity. Cote d'Ivoire, for example, was coming out of a civil war, although Ghana has remained more stable institutionally, and they also have a good macroeconomic management with and a good relation with multilateral institutions. So those countries will have a lot of potential. However, so depending on which policies will be adopted by the leadership, the growth could continue and eventually at a faster pace. So perhaps the third group of countries is definitely the country where will have more heterogeneous outcomes. So this group of countries include countries whose economic performance have been either very slow or have substantially oscillated between growth and decline over the past 2 decades. So the slow growers will include countries like Central African Republic, Chad, Zimbabwe, or the oscillating countries will include countries such as Gabon, Malawi, Nigeria, or Angola. Overall, some of those countries are more exposed than others. If I speak about Angola, for example, China was the primary buyer of 61% of total Angolan export, to which I can connect also the over $10 billion in all back loans that China provided to Angola. So given the broader context of the reduced spending of China on those type of issues, the countries such as Angola, which are relatively dependent on a few number of importers, will be the most affected. So I wanted to highlight at least those elements of resilience. So we have different group of countries, and within the three main categories, we'll also have a different subcategory with different level of resilience. And that is the reason why I'm telling you that I'm even more bullish now than before. Because except for some sectors, of course, I spoke about infrastructure. Infrastructure resources will be much more difficult to secure than before. Now, turning on some core elements of the book or some major trends so that I observe And I know we don't have a lot of time, so I will not go into details, but I suppose we can.
Yeah,
have
for anyone who's interested, well, the book's going to be out shortly, but perhaps a sweetener just for our audience.
Absolutely. So the book will be out on April 27th, but it's already available on April 27th.
So by the time people hear this, it'll be available. People can go get it. It'll definitely be available everywhere books are sold online. So go ahead and look for it. You can go Google it, and we'll put a link to it in our show notes. So we'll do
fantastic.
That.
So those are some of the key trends which make me be bullish about the continent. We have a fast population growth. As you know, by 2030, the continent will have 1.7 billion inhabitants. And of all, though, 50% of that population is in about seven countries. Of course, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Egypt, Democratic.
And Eugenio is helping South Africa there.
Absolutely. South Africa, yes. Kenya, Tanzania, Democratic Republic of Congo, Egypt.
You're part of history there, Eugenio.
So we also have a growth of the middle class and household consumption. I don't like to speak too much about middle class. I prefer to speak about the percentage of people with available discretionary income. So they will be slightly affected during the COVID crisis, but will jump back quickly again after the COVID crisis. So as a matter of fact, they may reach up to 43% of the population by 2030. And when you speak about those household consumption, sectors such as food and beverage, housing, healthcare, a sector where we'll have a steady growth given the population growth, but also the income growth.
I can also see how that's going to become much more of a priority for people in that category who probably took some of those things for granted. After a crisis like this, I imagine there's going to be an investment in that direction to
a massive investment. And that's a good point that you made, because it's connected also to the agriculture and agri-processing sector, the manufacturing and industrial development, construction and transport, which are some of the largest sectors. We have the fast urbanization. As you know, the continent will go from 6 to 17 cities of more than 5 million from 2015 to 2030, but also from 3 cities to 5 cities of more than 10 million inhabitants from 2015 to 2030. There's one thing that we call at the Brookings Institution, industries without smokestacks, that people have often overlooked, which are ICT-based industry. In fact, between 1998 and 2015, export in those industry were 6 times faster than in traditional manufacturing. And those industries are characterized by their exportability, tradability, and labor intensive. So they would definitely provide opportunities for African citizens. So the effort to close the infrastructure gap will continue, although will be affected, but will substantially continue. We have innovation and the fast digitalization. One thing that I like to remind people is that before, in the late 90s, New York City had more mobile phone subscribers than the entire continent of Africa. And now the continent have over 700 million mobile phone subscribers, much higher than that, but at more than 700 mobile phone subscribers. And when I last checked, we had more than 618 active herbs. Entrepreneurship is growing fast on the continent, more than 20%. It's one of the favorite activities of citizens. You have an increased stability. So in the late 80s, 90s, most of the unstable countries in the world were based in Africa. Although we still have many unstable countries on the continent, however, stability has broadly increased. We have, for the three last point, the improved business environment. 5 of the top 10 countries which had the best improvement in the ease of doing business, for example, in 2018, were located in Africa. And whether the countries are democratic or non-democratic, they really understand the need of improving the business environment. We have also the fast regional integration, independently of the African Continental Free Trade Area, especially with the regional economic committees, but also now increasingly with the African Continental Free Trade Area.
Outside of the Africa Union deal, what would you point to as more cohesion as far as like trade regionally?
So yeah, definitely you have the East African community. Also, you have some challenges with some of the countries. but it is one of the most integrated sub-region. You have the also economic community of West African states, where citizens can move. Of course, we have non-trade barriers, which remain challenges, such as infrastructure and sometimes administrative processes. And we also have the Southern, the SADC, so which is also an extremely important player. Lagger are countries in Central Africa, so we trade the least. One thing which is extremely important is that when African countries trade with one another, over 42% of the product exchange are manufactured products. So which means that these jobs are created, added values are created. But when they trade with the rest of the world, it's about 17%. So it's also a good thing to do business between African countries because they increase the industrialization, the diversification of the economies, as well as they allow the continent to be stronger, as I mentioned earlier, when negotiating with partners such as the United States, as I have seen when they were negotiating the post-AGOA. And another point that we don't necessarily speak a lot, but for which I'm very hopeful, is also the diaspora. So I think the diaspora is playing a critical role, building bridges, representing the continent, they are ambassadors of the continent, whether in trade, investment, research, innovation, which is important. I could speak about remittance and about many other factors, but I know that we are running out of time.
We're here for as long as you need. You're the one with the crazy schedule. So I'm actually glad that we've gotten through. And you noticed I wasn't interrupting you as often as I interrupt our guests. Eugenio will tell you that.
Thank you very much. You are very kind.
I interrupt a lot because I really did want our listeners to benefit as fully as possible from everything you had to say. And perhaps we'll have another chance to have you back. But by the way, I co-sign your diaspora point and the role being played by diasporan founders, diasporan investors, diasporan policymakers, even diasporans who are contributing from a distance to economies, you know, just through remittances, for example, or active participation in home economies and things of that nature. That's definitely not something to wink at. And so, listen, you've made a fairly compelling case. I wouldn't go as far as saying I've been satisfied in being able to unpack it fully. So please look forward to an invitation back for me to sort of carefully think through some of what you've put out here and possibly identify some of the areas that I'd like you to sort of unpack a little more, especially once I've been through your book fully. But for now, it suffices to say I'm glad to have someone as distinguished as you, as accomplished as you, as active as you in the matters that you come to be known as an expert at. It's also exciting to know that you are that much more bullish about the future of Africa, even despite what's going on in the world today. And one last time, I'm going to thank you for being on the show. Let me get this right. L'André Seigneur, full professor and founding co-director of the Fourth Industrial Revolution and Globalization 4.0 at Thunderbird School of Global Management. Thank you so much for being on the African Tech Roundup.
Thank you very much. I'm the one honored to have been invited and to have participated, including with our distinguished Eugenio. So thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Eugenio, do you have a few minutes for us to wrap things up after L'André leaves us?
I'm locked down, so unless my daughter knocks at the door, I'm here.
And you can tend to her as well if you need be. L'André, thank you so much, man.
Thank you very much. I have to leave. Bye-bye. Thank you very much again.
So, Eugenio, I was just burning listening to L'André. I think he really is passionate for the issues that he sort of outlines in his book. And the reason I was burning is, as you know, I'm constantly thinking about what could that mean? To what extent are you, as Osaruman likes to say, thinking of the world as it should be versus as it is, you know? And I wonder what you make of some of what he had to say.
Well, you know, I'm not an optimist by nature. And I think some of the trends are very much there. I can see it for countries like, you know, Ethiopia and Rwanda and so forth. The resilience, there would be even more anger for investing and for being there when certain things happen. One thing that I can't take out of my mind, and I think it wasn't explored as much in the conversation or in the book, is inequalities. Inequalities play in ways that just put a very powerful brake on some of the trends that L'André discussed. And unless we deal with it front and center, we will always see like bubbles and niches of like excellence and innovation and expertise, but we will forget so much of the continent. So
yeah,
being bullish is good. It's good to create dreams and vision people can buy into. But at the same time, living in South Africa, and especially during the COVID-19 crisis, you can't forget about that. And inequalities can actually help if factored in, creating more resilience version, maybe slower one, of what Laundrie talked about. So yeah, this is probably a missing piece that I would stress.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, you're an expat in South Africa. You're living in the northern suburbs of Johannesburg, correct?
Yeah. 10 minutes one from it.
Yeah, so one of the most pleasant areas of Johannesburg to be living in and raising a family. And I suppose it's definitely not lost on you just how many people in South Africa get born, live and die without ever experiencing the level of comfort and privilege you enjoy as an outsider living in the country.
Absolutely.
And let's talk about a practical example of how these dynamics impact real people and how we need to sort of watch how we don't get carried away by some of the whizzier, quote-unquote, solutions being proposed to the situation and how they might have an impact going forward. So let's take something like contact tracing, right? We see South Korea tracking people fairly successfully. We see India calling it a success, even though from an adoption standpoint, they need many, many, many more people sort of opting into this app that will help trace the spread or contribute to a data-led combating of the spread via, lack of a better term, surveillance, right? Using their mobile phones. The Chinese, of course, perfecting this. Just go on Twitter and see how citizens there are showing how effectively this thing works. And technically, yes, people are opting in. They're giving permission to their mobile networks to let the government know where they are in order to get on this bus and so on and so forth. But frankly, it's getting to the point where there's a technical opt-in, you know, as far as like the democratic aspect of this. Like, they're not forcing you to tell them where you are, but they are telling you that if they can't verify where you've been, you can't jump onto this bus or into this train station or into this apartment block or this neighborhood, right? And of course, in the name of getting us out of this trouble, It sounds pretty compelling, this case for like tech being able to sort of do things for us and help us get done this crazy task of surviving this virus when, yeah, I mean, there are concerning outcomes or potential outcomes for those of us who aren't at the highest end of privilege in this world versus those with less.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a techno optimist. I'm not a techno enthusiast. But I do think that in this phase, technology will be a bit determinant of, determinant is a word that I'm using, I never use, but in this case, I'm using thinking about it, of whether or not we can experience again certain forms of sociality. Said that, tech fixes are always a problem. And I use in my work the word of technopolitics, meaning like if technology is not grounded into a community, it's in a way of being, in a way of interpreting relationships of power, it will never work. And it was this very interesting case. We were talking earlier on about different sections of a society being either in agreement or in disagreement towards certain measures. And there was this case, even in super surveilling China, there was a case of a man who did something that we think impossible in order to game the system, is he left his phone at home. And we do think that we keep the phone with ourselves so it will be able to trace our contacts with other people. This guy didn't use a very tech-savvy fix. It just said, you know what, I'm going to do my own things and the phone is going to stay at home. So it's not going to collect all the traces of who I'm going to meet or not meet. And this person could have been a carrier of virus. Just to give an example of what it happens when...
So the next law might be if you own a phone, you have to have it on you at all times. Like an ID. Like an ID in some countries. I think it might still be law in Zimbabwe, for example, to be an ID carrier and not have it on you at all times.
And we'll be surrounded and submerged in the laws. But this is an example of when communities, you know, certain standards don't go together. But at the same time, going back to the discussion we were having about inequalities, we learned because of the work I do in a university that there are so many people who don't have phones or even at in a tertiary institution, or their phones are not enabled to do stuff that is needed for education. So reading stuff, downloading things and so forth. But these can be an obstacle obstacle, but these can also be an opportunity to take things into account. It's not just a smartphone. You know, in China and in South Korea, obviously, the expectation is everybody's going to be carrying a smartphone around. But also, like, feature phone have like Bluetooth, and some big powers are looking into using Bluetooth to enable certain forms of content tracing. In many countries, there are non-tech ways to build solidarity around certain kind of decisions. So I think we should have all these different things on the table. And you mentioned earlier on blockchain and China, a way to escape the kind of like dystopian scenario of the Chinese government tracing people through face recognition software and cameras and phones and so forth, is also possibly to seize the power of blockchain, not for currency, but for creating a global sense of trust into a tool that is not going to be managed by any single individual, being a company or government, but is going to be built in into a system that nobody actually manages and can trace whether or not I can be allowed to go into a train or step into a school. And these kind of ideas can
I wish come. You could see the look on my face right now.
Why?
That is so not going to happen. Like, come on.
But it could. And if Donald Trump wasn't withdrawing $200 million from the WHO, we could make a way into it. I know it's very expensive to run a blockchain and so forth, but it could be an opportunity for a different kind of global compact. I know this is over-optimistic and probably is just something we will put back into the drawer, but it's kind of a thought that we could have for a little bit. I don't think it's too crazy, because it would allow kind of humanity to be human, and we will allow not to have like our leaders, but having like a way to just have technology caring for us without us caring about who is having access to what we can't have access to.
The fact is, there is no version of that future that the most powerful economies and political players in the world are going to buy into at the expense of an erosion of their ability to continue to wield power. And for me, I feel like that shouldn't prevent us all from dreaming or striving towards idealistic expressions of creativity and projects, maybe even fuel our idealism. But I think we are blind to it at our own peril. And I think there's a binary conversation that's happening in the world because we're so desperate. Because I'm not a father, but I can imagine how, if I were, the well-being and health of my child is such a binary concern for me. As far as for many people who love their children, they would do anything to keep them safe. And I think appreciating how cornered we are in this position forces us to be a little more careful about just assuming that good will prevail from a situation like this. Am I a Debbie Downer today? I don't know. I just feel like I look at something like education, for example, which again is being billed as this fast forward opportunity Africa might have to reevaluate what great education at scale could look like on the African continent. And I think as a premise, that's amazing.
But if I can jump on the education one, I think it's such a moment of reckoning, and it could be. As a lecturer, I try my best to put in my syllabus the stuff that I would love to read if I was like 19 or 20 in this period in time. So I carefully craft it. I enjoy giving my lecture. But sometimes, as a conversation I was having with a colleague, we are an automatic pilot. We walk into a large lecture hall and we just start talking about stuff that we think is really interesting. And we have good feedback, and the students think it's interesting and so forth. But in a situation like these, where we can't say, oh, let's build just flashy online platform because it won't work in South Africa right now, we sort of ask ourselves harder question, like, what are the kind of skills, abilities, way to interpret the world that we would like our students to have at the end of this course? And maybe it's obvious, but these obvious questions are not questions that we ask ourselves that often. But we have to ask these questions right now because the bandwidth is very small. Students, even if they are young, they might have to take care of their own kids or their parents or their families or people affected. So we have to recognize they're in a period of very high anxiety and stress. And we have to get to the basic. That doesn't mean making our education more basic, but asking, like, what's education about? And I think this is fundamental. And it's not a question that myself or our colleagues were asking ourselves as easily a month ago. And I think it will stay with us.
Do you know what I like about what you've just said? I feel like that's closer to the pragmatic center that I want to encourage any African or Africa-focused proponent or Africa-based innovator to center around. I think we need to be asking how to deliver on basics, like almost a return to fundamentals. And that's not to say don't dream. I mean, I recently listened in on a Zoom call that a fairly high profile Nigerian entrepreneur slash investor was speaking in. And he often is on the side of like this really blind optimism that I sense feels obligatory for a lot of us who are born here and feel a sense of loyalty to the continent, which I understand and I think comes from a good place. But the one thing that I think really came out of what he shared and what resonated with me is his sense of how for innovators in Africa, like it's going to boil down to who can actually deliver on results within context, where this is no longer like a rhetoric point. It is a reality. Because the world is about to get really preoccupied. The Western world is about to get really preoccupied in preventing like complete and utter upheaval economically, that we are about to find out what it actually means to be left to ourselves. This is my sense of things.
That would be interesting.
And I feel like if we are not focusing in a disciplined fashion on things that actually move the needle in how we're going to replace all the, God forbid, all the people we're going to lose to this thing and the impact that's going to have on our economy in human terms. And it's so tempting right now to sort of just to sell moonshots, but I'm not inclined to sell moonshots when my family is trapped in Zimbabwe, you know? I don't know that it's healthy that we ignore how we got to the place where there's so few ICU beds in my hometown of Bulawayo in favor of like promoting the sense that, you know, we can still fly plasma by drone.
I'm absolutely with you. Tech solutionism, that shouldn't have any space right now.
You and I both know, like, the world is a super unfair place. And people don't get up in the morning waking up about, like, how can we fix Africa? Like, they really aren't.
No.
They, whoever they are, know themselves. Like, no one's waking up in the morning going, oh, my word, Africa's about to have the first recession in 25 years. No, they no one is actually concerned. And so in that world, there are stories that sell the idea that, you know, we're moving the needle on innovation, on change, on inclusion. People are dying, you know, like, so I don't know. For me, it's like maybe that's part of what might be the evolution of this show, because there's a side of me, if I'm honest, I've been flipping through some of our past shows and I'm like, what was I even on? Is this even real? What was I selling here? Like, I'm starting to feel like I've been selling false dreams.
I think it was a period. I think there was no not in bed, you know, like when Kenya in 2010 and all M-Pesa is going to take the world by storm and Africa is going to change. And you talked about it in your show, you know, that it's happening in Kenya. And then you try to move to South Africa and it doesn't work. You try to move it to the DRC, obviously it doesn't work and so forth. I think it was a sense of euphoria. And I think this kind of like gloomier and more tragic way of looking at things, paradoxically could be empowering. As much as like for some people not being on alcohol in for 3 weeks or maybe 5 weeks, first 2 weeks are just terrible. And then you start saying, you know what? I sleep better. I'm less mean to my wife or my kids or why. So I think if there is a next round of innovation, is not going to be the solution is of the people getting up and saying, let's fix Africa, but it's going to be a more grounded and more humane. It's not necessarily more, I don't know. It's not going to be the fix. It's not going to be as shiny, but possibly it's going to be more, again, the low tech. I strongly believe we still have to trial it. And maybe I will be back on the show and talking about that. The low tech, we resisted the illusion of going MOOC and going fancy and going TEDx or like edX or these. And we said, you know what? Let's use the post office to deliver the textbooks to the kids that are not into the campuses anymore. And let's just have basic conversation on humanity. And let's have the students write in their diaries as a way to learn about how the media talk about these crises and about other things. And maybe it's going to have a stronger impression on their lives than a super fancy background with the latest technology delivered at the exact time on Zoom or on other platforms.
I'm vibing with what you're saying in the same way I vibed with the anecdote you shared about how, you know, you guys at WITS came to the realization that, no, we can't just afford to be, we are not the University of Sheffield. You know what I mean? We're not the University of Sheffield that can just tomorrow turn on virtual teaching and learning and just carry on. Like, no. And you don't get to that realization by not soberly reflecting on the facts as they are.
And this, I think, is a, talking about democracy, I think it's a democratic forms of resistance. We accept the lockdown, but we don't accept the shiny online services. It's not that we have to accept wholesale, the whole package. A bit of it is fine because I protect myself, my kids, and I protect other people. But when I'm sold, shiny, fancy, super tech education, that's where we have to say no, because it will be completely out of place.
What we expect from a new normal also has to be rooted not in this idea we're sold by consulting firms and global institutions that are looking to sort of secure the debt that they've like farmed out. We need to be very careful that we don't let that agenda be set inappropriately to our detriment. And to the extent to which we ourselves are sort of advancing certain notions, we need to be clear on that. Like, this is a time for sobriety. And that's not to say that we'll never get to dream again, nor should we stop to dream. Perhaps even, dare I say, I can't believe I'm saying this on my show, our dreams need to take a back seat right now.
Probably. Or like other dream, let's have other dream taking a chance when they were like, probably like suffocated by too much hype and too much glitter. And maybe we can have more basic ones.
I really, really want to thank you for being on the show. It's probably one of the more disorienting episodes I've produced. I have 7 pages of preparatory notes for this show. And yeah, we got to some things, but I think I have preoccupying thoughts that I think make sense to just air out in this raw form. And so thank you again for indulging me in, you know, bringing to bear everything you do at WITS University. I know your role as a parent right now is on fleek. your academic career doesn't stop. And so I really, really thank you so much for being back on the show. Eugenio Garladone, guys, go check this man out. He's got an amazing book that really has informed to a great degree my view of the Africa-China, call it China-Africa relationship that's happening, particularly as far as technological issues are concerned.
It's accessible on Amazon. It's available on Zed Publisher on their website.
Zed Publisher, that's ZED, and they're independent publishers, so support them.
Yeah, rather than Amazon. If you have to choose which, it costs the same. If you have to choose which e-copy to get, I think Zed.
If you're
going to
do the
choice.
Book via e-copy, if you're going to consume it as an e-copy, go to Zed Publishers. That's Z-E-D. That's Z-E-D Publishers. So put in the name of the book, which is China, Africa, and the Future of the Internet. And then, of course, Z-E-D Publishers, and it'll take you straight to where it is. You're welcome, basically, because it's a great read, really insightful. And, of course, if you want more on the man himself, well, there's that episode I told you about, episode 132, where he unpacks that book and a ton more we didn't get to today. So go ahead and find that at africantechroundup.com. So one last time, thank you so much, Eugenio. And to all of you listening, thank you so much for being here. Folks, I think this is the time to let you know that I don't know. I really don't know. I often say take it easy to close, and I still wish everyone well, safety, and I wish you safety and health. But I really don't know. I really don't know as far as what, you know, I'm really torn about what we're here to do, what, you know, in serving you as an audience and serving you as a community and serving our continent and serving humanity. I'm really starting to feel some kind of way about our role in shaping what comes next. And so, yeah, spare a thought for us. For me and the team here at African Tech Roundup as we figure this out. And we'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you're thinking and going through. You can drop us a note on Twitter at African Roundup, on Instagram as well at African Roundup, or you can, you know, drop us an email. The email address is hello@africantechroundup.com. Give us a sense of what you think of everything we discussed and where you are at, where's your head at. Whatever you do, do take it easy, Africa.